The Airplane Geeks podcast is proudly sponsored by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. Visit aopa.org/learn-to-fly for your introduction to the exciting world of aviation and flight. This is a special edition of the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast. I'm not Max Flight, but your humble roving reporter and historian David Vanderhoof. In the following hour, you'll hear a small portion of what is known as Air Venture, or simply Oshkosh. This year, Whitman Airport hosted over 500,000 plus people over 7 days. Thanks to the 400,000 members of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, I was lucky enough to spend 3 days there to bring these interviews to you. Hopefully this little microcosm will bring you a slice of what AirVenture is. You go for the airplanes, you go back for the people. Airplane Geeks podcast, rock your wings. Land on your dot. Welcome to Oshkosh. This is David. We've made all the way down to the lower half of the South 40, and I'm standing near the Safari helicopters. They're kind of look like a other ubiquitous helicopter here at Oshkosh that flies around in circles. And I'm with Jessica Gibbs, the sales manager of CHR International. Jessica, thanks for being on Airplane Geeks.
Thank you for having us.
And standing next to her is Sean McGann. Sean, do you want to chime in? Tell me a little bit about the Safari helicopter.
Well, we've been developing the kit for about 30 years. It uses a 4130 chromoly steel frame, all TIG welded. We did borrow the bubble from the Bell 47, so you have an excellent view. We use a Lycoming 0360 180 horsepower engine, so we maintain a nice certified engine to keep the helicopter going. We're using titanium main shaft, titanium spindles on both the main and tail rotor transmissions. And both of those also include chip detectors and sight gauges. Also, like the Bell 47, we don't have a whole lot of exterior cowling around the engine, so pre-flight is very quick and very simple.
You said it was a kit. How long does it usually take to build? How many hours do you estimate?
The kit takes around 450 hours to build. All the main components come already pre-assembled. The tail rotor actually comes already factory balanced as well. They will be in crates, and you will be able to take those out and bolt those on. The frame and the cabin and the tail boom frame all come pre-welded and also factory powder coated. The main rotor blades are already assembled. The sheet metal is already affixed to the cabin, which is just held on with Klinkos to easily removed so you could build it. The main bubble is already mounted as well. And then the skids and the shroud are already preformed.
Sounds like a lot of less work than your normal average home-built kit. So anything else you'd like to tell me about it?
The cost of the kit is $149,000. The show special right now that we're running is for $135,000. That's for the complete kit. Includes a brand new Lycoming 0360 engine. It also includes all of the nuts, bolts, washers, everything to build it. The only additional cost is the avionics.
Well, thank you for being here. Thank you for being on the show. It's a really neat helicopter, and I've enjoyed watching them fly around all week.
Thank you. And we've had three of them out here flying all week this week. We've had a great show. We want to thank EAA for putting this on.
Well, thank you. This is David. We're down in the South 40 at Oshkosh. And as I'm walking up, I saw a stunning blue and orange Cessna, and I'm standing here with the owner. Welcome to Airplane Geeks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Michael, and the owner's Michael Langston. And Michael, tell me about what we're standing under.
We're standing under the wing of a 1952 Cessna 195B that is 60 years old this year, that I picked up just 4 months ago. Brought it back to California and had it painted this pearlescent orange and candy blue over silver to support my company, Wingster.Aero.
And what's Wingster.Aero?
Wingster.Aero is an online aviation community developed to spread the passion of general aviation, to get people involved. We have over 5 cameras on the aircraft. We film everywhere we fly. And we're just trying to get people excited about general aviation again through the media that people are consuming, like your podcast and video, to get young people excited about flying aircraft.
And what... how did you choose paint scheme?
The paint scheme, I have to give credit to my business partner, Eric. He loved the color orange, and blue is a complementary color to orange. So then we went out and just found the nicest orange we could find, and this candy blue. And the two went together so well that they won the choice, and here it is in orange and blue.
And how are you enjoying Oshkosh this year?
I love Oshkosh. You know, I've been here one other time, but I've never flown in before. This is the first time I had the opportunity to fly into Oshkosh, and what an incredible experience to fly in with this many other people. 99.99% of people here have something in common. We all love aviation, and it doesn't matter who you stop and talk to, you're going to get a good story. And look around us. There's thousands and thousands of airplanes all here at the same time. It's really incredible.
Well, thank you very much for taking a few minutes with me. Again, tell me what your website is.
It's www.wingster.aero, WINGSTER.AERO.
Thank you for joining Airplane Geeks.
And thanks for having me, David.
This is David. I'm moved all the way down the other end of the field to the Warbird line, and I'm standing next to a unusual twin-engine beached aircraft, and the new proud owner of it, John Hess. John, tell me a little bit about the beach we're standing in front of.
It is a Beechcraft AT-11. It was one of the very first beach models produced. It was made in 1941, in August of 1941. It was made to be able to train the bombardiers going to the war. So they would have a Norden bomb sight in the front of the airplane. You'd have an instructor and a student, and they would practice dropping bombs so that they could get the accuracy and learn how to use the bomb sight at high-altitude bombing missions for the B-17s and B-24s of the day. And this airplane, now we're slowly restoring it back to more and more original, and now it still has the Norden bomb sight, but we're going to add the guns, as it was a gunnery trainer too. And then we'd like to make the bomb bays functional again so we can kind of demonstrate how it was configured in the early days.
When you got it 3 months ago, did it have the Norden bomb sight?
Yes, it did have the Norden bomb sight. The previous owners have all been working very hard to restore this and maintain it, and I'm the next keeper of this educational piece here, and we're just really proud to kind of help restore it and show it to the general public and help educate other people like we're getting an education now, and hopefully get some veterans come by and tell us more of their stories about what they did with these airplanes.
Well, it's a very... oh, and it has a name. You want to tell me what the name is?
Tantalizing Takeoff was the name that one of the previous owners had put on it. And I can tell you these airplanes were always known to be a little bit squirrely and all, so they for different reasons, they have the name Tantalizing Takeoff, but it's kind of appropriate there for any tail dragger.
And how does it fly?
Oh, Beechcrafts and AT-11s, Beech-18s, any of those are great flying airplanes. Any tail dragger is a little more... harder to handle in the ground and air-ground transitions, but boy, they're fantastic flying airplanes.
And the big glass nose on the front doesn't affect its flying characteristics?
It is slower than most. It wasn't designed for speed. It's probably a little bit slower than other Beechcraft, but and it adds a little different view out of the cockpit. You have more of your view blocked by that nose being the way it is, but it's just it is so neat for somebody to be able to be up in there, and you're actually allowed to sit up there for takeoffs and landings with a seatbelt. So it's something really neat that somebody can experience being in the front of an airplane and seeing the full view.
Well, thank you for bringing it to Oshkosh. It's really cool, and a warbird that you wouldn't normally see, one that actually trained the pilots that flew all of the other bigger famous warbirds like the B-17. Thank you.
Well, thank you for sharing this.
This is David. I'm standing in front of one of the big exhibits here at Oshkosh 2012, the JU-52. I'm with Cedric, and Cedric's part of the flight crew. Cedric, thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
You're welcome.
Tell me what it's like to fly a JU-52.
To fly like a JU-52, I mean, first of all, it's an honor. It's a nice big toy for a pilot's lover. Once it's in the air, it flies like more or less every plane. It has some aerodynamic and it's smooth. For landing and takeoff, I mean, you need to have some tail drag experience. But if you have tail drag experience, it's not that different than any tail dragger, any plane.
And is it a little different flying three motors instead of two or one?
Well, I mean, today we see that everybody is going to two engines to have less maintenance costs, less engines. Though with those three, let's say, still original BMW engines, you can be happy to have as much as possible. Because also today we had on the left side, he was shooting below 1500 RPM. So, I mean, you never know what can happen. So especially with those nice BMWs, you're happy to have three.
Tell me a little bit about the sponsor.
A sponsor, this time Remova. He has sponsored the trip from Switzerland, from Dübendorf, to all the way to here to Oshkosh, then to Los Angeles, back from Los Angeles to Oshkosh. We stay here for 1 week at Oshkosh, and then we fly to New York, do some trips in New York, then Toronto, and then fly all over back to Switzerland.
And how long was the flight across the Atlantic?
50 hours. If you count, it's like from leaving Switzerland to until, let's say, Newfoundland, you have to count like 50 hours. Yeah. I mean, it all depends also a bit about the weather, but during summer, it's not too bad, and you can count it 50 hours.
And what were the legs like?
The big legs were like 6 to 8 hours. So especially once you leave New Iceland, depending on the weather, also you can either cross over the glacier. That's tricky because especially if one engine quits, the ceiling, the minimum altitude is so high that you could not do it with two engines. So you have to go all the way around the Greenland. And then you pick up between 6 and 8 hours. Those are the longest legs, from Iceland to Greenland, from Greenland to Newfoundland. Then.
And I was pleasantly surprised. I was expecting to see a couple of flat passes. You guys actually fly the airplane, yanking and banking. It was a really awesome experience. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Do you have fun flying it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, once here, I mean, we have the UAIR, the company. It's an AOC. It's an air operator certificate. We have four of them. Three are in the original shape, like from 1939. Delivery was in October, just before the Second World War. Has been since before 30 years. It was operated by the Swiss Army. And then 30 years ago, it's our official 30 years anniversary this year. The Junkers 52 is now with UAIR, and we're happy to fly those, like also information with 3 and 4 of the U-52, and so we are used to have banks more than 60 or 90 to fly also information with all the other Junkers.
Well, thank you very much for bringing it to Oshkosh.
You're welcome.
This is David again on day two of our AOPRA-sponsored Oshkosh adventure. Up until yesterday, I'm sitting near the biggest airplane on the flight line. Unfortunately, you guys got supplanted by a C-5 overnight, but I'm with Bruce Johnson, who is the Director of Aircraft Operations and Maintenance for Orbis. Bruce, tell me about what you brought to Oshkosh, the little airplane behind us.
Well, we brought you the oldest DC-10-10 left in the world flying. It's the number two airframe off the assembly line, and it was the McDonnell Douglas test airplane. Wasn't sold to the airlines initially, so it has a lot of history as far as McDonnell Douglas goes and the DC-10.
But she's got a much more important mission now these days. Tell us a little bit about Orbis.
Yes, Orbis has been around since 1982. We're a humanitarian, nonprofit humanitarian organization. that goes around the developing world trying to eliminate preventable blindness in the world. As you we've mentioned the other day, there's some 285 million visually impaired people in the world. 90% of those live in the developing world, but the staggering number is 80% of them can either be cured or repaired back to vision again.
And how does the DC-10 fit into this mission?
Well, the DC-10 actually has been, we started in 1982 with a DC-8 that was donated by United Airlines. And in 1992, we picked up the DC-10 because the DC-8, as most of you know, is a narrow-bodied jet. And it just didn't have the capacity for the OR and everything that we put in this DC-10. So the DC-10 in 1992, we retrofitted with a full-blown surgical suite inside the airplane. We have a classroom, we have an AV, an IT room, we have a laser room, we have the OR, we have sub-sterile recovery, a warehouse for aircraft parts and medical supplies, and we're self-sufficient. We have a we have our own oxygen generator on board. We can make hospital-grade oxygen within 5 minutes of startup in the morning. We have a water purification system. We carry our own ground equipment, air conditioners, generators, power converters, the whole gamut. So we basically have a full-blown hospital with wings.
It's a lot of stuff to pack into a DC-10.
It is. It's and it takes a toll on the aircraft's weight. It's sitting on the ramp here with at 305,000 pounds with all the equipment in. We can't even put a full load of fuel. And that's one of the reasons why we're going to the new MD-10. The new MD-10 that's being built right now, that was donated by FedEx, is out in California being retrofitted for some of the modifications for the hospital. But it's going to it has a longer wingspan, larger engines, bigger fuel tanks, and will basically double our range and give us more capability. So that's sort of the future of Orbis coming up with the new airplane.
And I understood yesterday when talking about before the interview, you guys have an outstanding relationship with FedEx. Is that correct?
Yes, FedEx is our, we have many aviation sponsors, but FedEx is our largest one. That's where we get the majority of our pilot force. That's where our simulator training is done. It's actually where our approved training program is accomplished there at FedEx. So we have like 16 FedEx pilots that donate their time to fly the airplane from place to place without pay. We have not paid for a pilot in 30 years. And we have four United pilots also, because United used to do what FedEx did years ago. So, but now FedEx, actually the motors on this airplane right now, they roughly are $3 million to $3.5 million. We couldn't afford to overhaul them. FedEx donated it to them and let us use them. When we don't need them any longer, we'll return them. But right now we get to use those motors.
So how about we describe maybe a mission profile? What's involved when you go overseas? What's the prep for it? How long does it take? How long are you over there? Those kind of questions.
All right. Ideally, first of all, we have to be invited. A country needs to know who we are, has to invite us in. And then we'd like to start anywhere from 24 months out down to around 12 months out. You need at least 12 months to set up a program. Because first of all, you need to know what the subspecialties are for the eye care that they need, what kind of training that they need. And remember, the one thing I haven't said is we are a training institute. So the way we're going to try to eliminate preventable blindness in the world is to train the trainers. So when we leave and walk away, they continue to train and do the service that we train them how to provide. So basically 24 months to 12 months out, we work with a hospital to decide on the needs of the country and the local hospital needs there. And we marry up healthcare professionals to come in and do the education and skills exchange necessary for them to go to the next level. Of course, there's also all the logistics. We need the supplies for the medical supplies, because we donate all the medical supplies to the local the locals where we go and work. Airport logistics, customs, immigration, hotels, the transportation. So all that takes some time. Also, all of our doctors have to be have at least a temporary medical license within those countries. So all these processes take a lot of time. And then once that's all done, we go ahead, fly in. It takes us about a half a day to set up, get all the equipment off, get the hospital set up, and we're ready for surgery.
What specific? So you're losing the DC-10 we're in front of us. You're getting an MD-10. What other kind of capabilities is that going to bring to your table?
Well, there's several things. First of all, it'll modernize the hospital. It modernizes the cockpit. One of the problems we're having right now is we're starting to face some of the. It's a 41-year-old airplane, so we're starting to face some issues with rebuilding some of the avionics and so on. So it's either going to this airplane would either need to be. Have a new instrument package put in it. There's also some new instrument requirements coming up into international airspaces. Currently, this one can fly in any airspace, but in the next upcoming years, it's going to need an upgrade. So that will help. Range is another one. Gross weight, we can carry more weight. The other thing is we're going to change the design of the hospital. It's going to be a modular concept, meaning that the hospital could be removed to either change its configuration, or in the event the airplane needs some maintenance done on it, we can remove the hospital. So whenever, you know, every 2 or 4 or 6 years, we could move it. Or in the worst case is, as many of you may know in the aviation industry, sometimes you might crack a spar or corrosion may set in an airplane and render it unusable. Our current airplane, if it was, we were to lose the aircraft, we would lose an aircraft and a hospital. The new design will allow us to just change airplanes, but the hospital will be modular and move it out.
Okay, we've talked a lot about Orbis. Let's talk a little bit about your career, Bruce. Tell me, we have a lot of young listeners that want to go into a career in aviation, and this is a very different career in aviation. Can you tell me a little bit about your career?
Yeah, I did everything the hard way, I think. I started off as an aircraft mechanic. I had a 4-year scholarship to go play football at the University of Wisconsin, and whatever reason didn't go do it. I grew up in northern Michigan up here. My dad had airplanes. I started flying when I was 14, sold on my 16th birthday. And instead of doing the smart thing and following through with the college initially, I didn't do that. So then I went in the military, U.S. Air Force, as an enlisted guy, and started off as an aircraft mechanic. Received my A&P license. Partway through, I guess at about the 6-year point, realized my love for flight again. And the Air Force, I found out that the Air Force allowed to have enlisted guys in the cockpit of an airplane as a flight engineer. So I cross-trained from an aircraft mechanic, which was required at the time. You had to be an aircraft mechanic to be an engineer. So I cross-trained to be a flight engineer, went to fly the AWACS airplane for some 22 years, both active duty and the reserve, and finished up a reserve career in 2005 after 27 years, 10 years active duty and 17 in the reserves. And of course, during that 17 years in the reserve time frame, I went to work for Boeing Aerospace as a simulator instructor for the U.S. Air Force on the AWACS training program out of Tinker. And then in 1996, the U.S. Air Force reactivated the 970th. It was actually one of only two squadrons that had the Bugs Bunny, the Disney characters on them. And they reactivated that in the AWACS, and I became a flight engineer again in the reserves. And then I went to FedEx in 1996. Went to FedEx and worked for FedEx till 2008 as a volunteer crew member on this. And then in 2008 became the director of operations. So sort of a long maintenance operations background.
It's a way to go, and you're in a very important role now. So, Bruce, I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing your stories with us. And it's a very important mission, and we hope... tell us where people could find Orbis Online.
Orbis Online, www.orbis.org. You can go online and check out. If you want to be a volunteer, there's job applications for being a full-time employee. There's volunteer aspects on there. There's the donations. That's the one big thing to remember is we are a full nonprofit organization. It's private donations like yourself, myself, and, of course, some big organizations do help us. We're not affiliated necessarily with the government or anything. We are a private nonprofit organization that needs your donations and support, whether it be support as a volunteer or support monetarily.
Well, again, thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your stay at Oshkosh.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Hi, this is David. I have just arrived at Oshkosh. I've been on the grounds about an hour. We've already had one major downpour, but I've taken shelter in a tent in front of an airplane we've talked about a lot with the CEO of Piaggio Aero, John Bingham. John, thank you for being on the Airplane Geeks.
Hi, hello, how are you?
Very good. As I said previously before we got online, we've talked about this airplane a lot. You want to tell me about what we're this unique aircraft we're sitting in front of?
Sure, in front of our stand here at Oshkosh, and we're right down on the flight line at the front of Oshkosh. We have a Piaggio P180 Avanti 2, which is our current aeroplane. The aircraft is made in Genoa in Italy. It can be between a 7 and a 9 passenger aircraft. It has a rather unique appearance, which if you've been talking about it on the show before, then basically many people will be aware it's a very unique aircraft when you see it on a ramp at an airport. But all the uniqueness and many features that you see on the aircraft are all there for a reason. The aircraft is the fastest twin turboprop in the world. Very fast, 402 knots, which it translates to 463 miles an hour, 745 kilometers an hour. So it's a turboprop with the speed of a mid-sized jet.
And it has classic Italian lines and design, and it's unique. It's a pusher. Tell me a little bit about the engines and why the pusher instead of a tractor.
Okay, it's got two Pratt & Whitney PT6A 66B engines on them. That's the uprated version of the PT6. It generates 1630 horsepower, derated to 850 horsepower. The reason why they're there, number of things. I think it's quite funny. Our chief test pilot puts it best when he talks about, have you ever seen an ocean liner with a propeller at the front? No, you haven't. And I have to say to you, for us, we believe that it's best to have the props and the noise behind us and as you push your way through the air. So the props are counter-rotating, that's what complements also one of the other key attributes of the aircraft, which is the serenity of the inside of the aircraft. Because besides being a very, very big cabin, the biggest in its class because it's a full stand-up cabin, it also, because of the way the plane is made and it has a small front wing, it enables us to push the main wing towards the back of the aircraft, mount the engines and the props facing backwards, which means that the cabin is entirely free of any aspect of the wing, and as a result of that, with the engines mounted backwards as well, there is no noise inside. So if we were having this conversation at 41,000 feet, 31,000 feet, 35,000 feet, whatever, we'd be having it at this level. It would be a conversation. We wouldn't be shouting at each other.
And how is the fuel burn? Does the pusher propellers change the fuel burn of the PT6s, or tell us about the efficiency of the aircraft?
The efficiency of the aircraft is huge. The design itself is an efficiency because the aircraft actually has three lifting surfaces, with the actual fuselage acting as a lifting surface as well. So front wing, fuselage, and also the main wing as well. As far as the efficiencies are concerned, carefully made so that basically it gives you a huge passenger vessel inside, which maximizes the space there, so there's an efficiency there. In terms of operating efficiency, under 100 gallons an hour. And when you compare that to a mid-sized jet that does the same sort of speed, same sort of performance, same sort of missions, it's less than half. So, I mean, it really is. It's a significantly different operating cost proposal over that of a mid-sized jet.
And let's talk about piloting it. Is it a difficult transition going to the canard and the pusher props?
I don't think so. I mean, I have to say to you, I'm a pilot myself. I'm not fully rated on the Piaggio, but from our pilots who fly, I have to say to you, there's no real transition problems. We also make sure that we put any transitioning and any recurrency training in the hands of specialists. So all of our training is handled by flight safety out of West Palm Beach in Florida.
All glass cockpit.
All glass cockpit, and for that we use a Rockwell Collins ProLine 21 system. Very well recognized system, known for its reliability, known for its capability, and also its flexibility. So it provides maximum information for the pilots as they fly the Piaggio P180.
Well, I really appreciate you taking your time. It has seriously become one of the favorite airplanes of, and of course the following comment, as we've said, was you can hear it coming, and I personally know when one leaves Philadelphia International, because I'm right underneath the flight pattern, I know when one's leaving, because it's got kind of a melodic sound to it, and I appreciate you taking the time on Airplane Geek.
No problem at all. It's one point on that sound. It's very interesting. As a weight saving on the aircraft, we actually don't use any de-icing on the props, and so as a result of that, the difference in tonality that you hear in the tone when you hear a Piaggio flying, the exhaust gas is escaping over the props, and that's what keeps the props free of ice. So we recycle the hot air from the exhaust over the props, and that's why you have a different tonality when it's flying past you in the sky.
Well, again, thank you very much.
Great, my pleasure.
This is David. I'm at Oshkosh's local drive-in, Artie and Ed's. I'm with Trey. And Trey brought an unusual car to Artie and Ed's, the drive-in. Tell me a little bit about what I'm staring at in the parking lot.
Well, this is the plane-driven PD-2. It's a rotable aircraft. It's based on the Glacier Sportsman. And it drives 73 miles an hour on the road, goes about 140 in flight, and it has a separate drive engine, drive pod, to propel it on the road that's at the rear of the vehicle, single wheel at the rear for driving, and that package rides in the cargo area for flight, so it's in the CG range and out of the wind. So that helps us fly almost as a stock airplane, and we're very pleased with it. Our current remaining challenge, we're driving great and flying great, and we're trying to get the transition time between the modes down to our goal, which is 10 minutes for one person. So we're working very hard on that.
And what is it right now?
Right now it's well over an hour, which obviously would limit very much the utility. If it can't transition in a reasonable fashion, it's more of a gimmick, but we're trying to make it a truly useful transportation tool. And we're trying to add the safety for VFR pilots, giving them more options when they hit bad weather is the basic idea.
Just to make this quick, because I know you're doing other interviews, tell us where we can find and see the airplane online.
Online, it's at planedriven.com, and there's some interesting video of it flying and driving in traffic in the real world. And we try to keep that updated, although we're very focused on just making it work, so the website sometimes lags our progress. And of course, we're still here at Oshkosh at the Glacier booth.
Well, thank you for taking the time and being on Airplane Geeks.
Thanks for your interest.
Everybody, you're looking good for the ground. Woo! On the route, pilots dream about the whole wide world around. Rock your wings, everybody. You're Oshkosh inbound. Rock your wings, rock your wings, rock your wings.
peculiar to the art of aviation. Every airplane in the sky from way down low, the way of body and a rock that we just don't come in vibration.
This is David, and my seaplane or bust thing, I finally got to seaplane base, and I'm standing here in probably the most picturesque part of Oshkosh with Paul Seehafer, the chairman of the seaplane base. Paul, thanks for being on Airplane Geeks.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell me about what seaplane base is.
Well, the seaplane base is, this particular seaplane base is probably the most unique seaplane base in the world. This is only open 1 week out of the year. This is private property the rest of the year, owned by the Vetti family, and they've been very gracious to allow us to use this seaplane base for 1 week out of the year. And it's just a beautiful property. It's 27 acres of land. It has about 3,000 feet of waterfront property and a parking lagoon that looks like it was designed to park seaplanes protected away from big water and waves. Lake Winnebago is a very, very large lake. I can't remember. I think it's 137,000 acres, something to that effect. And it can get really rough out here at times. So we have to park the airplanes in this parking lagoon on mooring buoys. And one of the more unique features of the seaplane base is the fact that we tow all of our airplanes from when they arrive at the docks into the parking lagoon, and they're moored. We don't have a beachfront. We would love to have that, or sand, I should say, sandy beaches. So that's why we have to tow the airplanes around. And I think this is the only place you'll ever see that in the world. And it's when you watch the boat drivers, one of the things when you come to the seaplane base, just pay attention to those boat drivers pulling those airplanes around, especially if there's any kind of wind. You know, they'll hook a 4,000-pound seaplane to a 14-foot aluminum boat with a 20-horsepower motor and have to maneuver it to the dock. There's times that pilots want their airplanes towed out into the bay for takeoff, so they pull them out and then release them and let them start up out there. It takes 3 years to train a boat driver just to pull an airplane around. And they have a very unique system that was developed years ago here at the base and how to tow the airplanes. And, of course, not every airplane is the same. We have flying boats, little flying boats. We have big flying boats, airplanes that land on their hull or land on their belly. And then we have float planes that have pontoons. And you'll see the majority of the airplanes out here are float planes or pontoon-type aircraft. And so when they tow, they have to tow all different kinds.
What else would we see out here in this peaceful serenity that is not Whitman Airport?
Well, obviously you're going to see a lot of seaplane flying as long as the weather cooperates. The neat thing about seaplanes is seaplane pilots are used to coming and going on their own. And here we have some control because we're obviously close to the airport and we have to honor that and keep our guys away from all that activity. But you'll notice that there's, if it's a nice day, there's a lot of flying going on, and a lot of the pilots like to demonstrate the aircraft and let the people that come down here see what it looks like. And a lot of people don't know, they've never seen a seaplane take off. And a lot of them are surprised sometimes how long it takes to get off the water. It takes about twice the horsepower to get a seaplane off the water than it does a land aircraft. So these are pretty high performance aircraft overall. And as you can hear by some of the noise in the background.
And every night is a different event. I understand tonight you have your watermelon social. You want to tell me just a little bit about that?
Well, our watermelon social, let's see, this would be year 24 if I remember right. Our watermelon social is an event where a lot of our friends over at the airport want to come out and visit us, but kind of hard to get everybody in one place at one time. So we started a social that we now call the watermelon social, and it's because we serve watermelon. And we also have a dinner and soda and water and some adult beverages. And it typically has around 700 people that attend, most of us and then all of our friends from the airport that want to come out. And it's a good time. If it's a beautiful evening, we'll have guys flying. We give out our awards to the seaplanes that had asked to be judged. And we hand out awards for our volunteers that are, based on terms of service and that sort of thing. And short little program, some door prizes, that sort of thing. We do have other activities during the week, but the seaplane base, unlike the airport, probably the biggest difference between us and the airport is, for anybody that's ever been to Key West, it'd be a good example. They quickly learn, like, if you're an early riser, and you want a cup of coffee at 6 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock in the morning, you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody with the door open because they open their doors when they feel like it. And we're maybe a little more structured than that, but for the most part, we are pretty laid back. We don't have schedules for, flying activities, or there's no air show. We just encourage fun flying. And at night, a lot of times, our activity is sitting around a campfire and sharing stories and learning from each other and having a good time.
Well, Paul, I appreciate it. For a first-timer, it's an amazing thing. And it was great to be able to come out here finally. So appreciate you taking the time and being on Airplane Geeks.
Well, thank you very much.
This is David in the Sikorsky tent. Last year, I had three very wonderful interviews with the Sikorsky team, and we talked about the unofficial fastest helicopter in the world, the X-2. This year, and behind the X-2 was a small model of what Sikorsky was going to grow the X-2 into, the Raider. Well, this year, Sikorsky outdid themselves and bought a full-scale mock-up of the Raider. And I'm here with the program coordinator, Douglas Scheidler.
Scheidler.
Doug, thank you for being on the Airplane Geeks, and tell me a little bit about what we're standing in front of.
What we're standing in front of is the S-97 Raider aircraft, and the aircraft is targeted for the Armed Aerial Scout mission for the U.S. Army. That is the replacement to the Kiowa Warrior. And like last year, showed you the X-2. That was a rigid rotor coax system with a pusher prop on it. What we've done is taken that same technology from the X-2 tech demonstrator and applying it to a military application. This aircraft will fly at 10,000 feet, 95 degrees a day in an armed reconnaissance mission or in a special ops mission at a 6K95. It has 2.7 hours worth of endurance. It is a single engine aircraft, has great deal of capability. It operates at a max gross weight of slightly over 11,000 pounds. The aircraft is all fly-by-wire, just like the X-2. We're leveraging the technology that we developed on the Blackhawk for the UH-60M upgrade, which is a triplex fly-by-wire, That same system's going over to 53K, the Marine Corps heavy lift aircraft, and we're taking that and putting it in this aircraft. So quite excited about where it's going. We're looking forward to the competition with the U.S. Army coming up in the near future. And again, aircraft, rigid rotor coax system. This aircraft will fly 220 knots in an armed configuration, in a clean configuration, 240 knots. Have the attributes of hovering like an aircraft, but it will also have the handling characteristics of an airplane at speed.
What's the advantage of the rigid rotor?
The rigid rotor provides the lift as well as maneuverability in the aircraft. It will sustain over 3G maneuverability capability, which means it can have half the turn radius of any other conventional helicopter at speeds.
And what are the missions we're talking about flying with this?
The missions are, first, the armed reconnaissance scout profile. The second is an armed attack bird. And the third is a special operations for troop insertion or extraction.
And what's the difference between the missions and the air? I know that on one side of this we have rockets, on the other side we do not. Talk about a little bit the payload capabilities and such.
Yeah, this mock-up is configured so that we have payload on one side. On the actual prototypes that we're building, there'll be payloads on both sides. We'll have doors to access the cabin. The cabin is set up to demonstrate flexibility. First off, for an armed aerial scout, it could take an extra Robertson fuel tank on board and a reload of armament. Or for a special operations mission, up to 6 troops on board for insertion or extraction.
So when are we going to see the real one?
The real one is currently in fabrication. We're fabricating the fuselage right now. First flight will be in 2014. We'll go through our engineering shakedown of it, and then we'll be demonstrating in 2015. Quite excited about it.
And this time we're going to have officials when we go break the record?
We'll have all types of officials in the aircraft flying. That's the purpose of producing 2 aircraft, one the demonstrator, and the other one will be for the engineering. But the demonstrator, we're going to be taking people up in there, flying it, experiencing what the X2 technology will bring to the battlefield.
And let's diverge a little bit. Tell me about it. What's other happenings at Sikorsky besides Raider? You talked about the new improved CH-53. Why don't you talk a little bit about that, can you?
Yeah, 53K is currently in fabrication right now. We'll go into flight testing in the latter part of 2013, beginning of 14 time frame. We have 4 fuselages being fabricated down in West Palm Beach, going through ground testing right now. That aircraft has a max gross weight of 88,000 pounds. So it's an amazing vehicle. It operates in the same footprint that the current 53Es do, and has twice the lift capability.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time, and as always, thank you for coming to Oshkosh. I can't wait to see in 2014 or 2015 the real one. And thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Thank you very much.
This is David. We're in a van trying to cool off, and we're having the Super Hornet demonstration, and I'm here with Teresa Stokes. And Teresa Stokes is an air show performer, but she does it a little differently. Teresa, what is it you actually do for a living?
I wing walk on the outside of Gene Susie's biplane called the Showcat.
And what would make you want to walk on a wing?
It beats getting a job, you know, one of those things.
So tell me about how you got involved with Gene and how you started wing walking.
Actually, I was already an aerobatic pilot when I met Gene, and he had just outfitted the airplane modified a Grumman AgCat for air shows and wing walking. And I went to visit him in his hangar the day that he first attached the wing stand and had a professional try it out and test it. And they finished all the testing, and I said, "Looks like fun. Let me try it." And I went for a ride just for fun. And it was love at first time. I mean, I was hooked. But I had no intention of being a wing walker. And then later in the year, when the season rolled around, the girl that was going to be his wing walker left at the last minute. So I said, well, I'll fill in until you find a real wing walker. And I'm still filling in 24 years later.
So adding to the adage, there's nothing more permanent than something that's temporary.
That's the truth.
So tell our listeners a little bit, what is it like being up there on the wing as Gene's rolling the airplane and looping the airplane. What does it feel like?
Oh, it's so spectacular. I mean, it's an extreme thrill ride that you cannot imagine. And at the same time, it's like an extreme workout. It's very physical, very violent. Might look graceful from here, but it's really rough up there. And it beats you up, and you have to really scramble and run hard. But the same, at the same time, I'm just screaming and laughing and having a ball, especially during the aerobatics when I'm strapped in and don't have to climb. I'm just looking at the incredible view. Because you don't have fuselage in your way or windows or anything. You're just out there.
And you climb, some wing wingers take off attached to the wing. You actually climb out onto the wing and then hook up into your harness, correct?
Actually, no. I take off on the bottom wing off on the right side, and I'm just hanging on in the cross wires there. And Gene takes off and does a barrel roll with me there. And then later I climb into the front cockpit and up to the top where there's a wing stand. I get in front of that big post and strap in with the waist belt. And then we begin the aerobatics.
So you're only attached to the airplane with a waist belt?
Yeah, that's right. And then later in the show, after our inverted pass, that's my signal to start the passes. And we do, like, I'll take the belt off and hang by my knee in one pass and then come back and stand on my head in another. We do various passes back and forth in front of the crowd low.
And how do you come up with this stuff? I mean, at some point, you have to say, well, I have to try it. I mean, this is phenomenal what you do.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, well, we just sort of practiced, well, let's try this. And we work out different maneuvers. And the ones that didn't work or took too long, we didn't want it to be boring. So we want to make fast-paced as much as possible. We would leave those out. And we kind of developed a routine, and then, it's actually safest to stick with what you've got. We very rarely change it. When we do, we have to really practice a lot because, it's better to keep a set routine so you know what's coming at all times.
And you have another career besides walking on wings on the weekend. Tell me a little bit about your other career.
Well, I'm also an aviation and space artist, and I've done all kinds of artwork, actually. I used to do artwork for rock bands, but now I'm into aviation and space, and I have limited edition prints of my art, and a couple of my paintings have gone into two different space shuttle missions, so I'm really honored for that, because I want to go.
So where could people see your art?
TeresaStokes.com. It's Teresa with no H, just T-E-R-E-S-A.
And you've been with Gene for 24 years, and how much longer do you think you'll be doing this? Another 24, 48?
Who knows? Jessie Woods was a barnstorming wing walker from the 20s, and she tried it again at age 84, and just not sitting in her living room. She loved it. So she can do it, who knows? I don't know how much longer.
So I'll give you a little word association. Tell me what does Oshkosh mean to you?
Oh gosh, it's like old home week. It's like family week. It's like a family reunion. You get to see everybody that you see, a few from this show and a few from that show, and this is like the gathering. Everybody's here and then some. So I mean, even my friends from home, I see more of them here than I do at home because I'm gone all the time. So and that's just the one small part of it. It's just so incredible. I've been here so long, and I still, go gaga over it. I can't believe it. It's incredible.
Well, Teresa, it's been really fun. I appreciate you taking the time, and thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Well, thank you for having me, and everybody, keep coming to Oshkosh.
This is David at day two of our Oshkosh adventure here for AOPA and the Airplane Geeks. I'm standing in front of one of the rarest aircraft on the flight line, a Curtis C-46 Commando by the name of Tinkerbell, and I'm with the Warriors and Warbirds from North Carolina and one of their co-founders, Bob Russell. Bob, thanks for being on the Airplane Geeks.
It's my pleasure to be here. I'm going to talk about Tinkerbell.
Well, let's talk about Tinkerbell. What is she? Where did she come from? And then what's the Warriors and Warbirds?
Well, first of all, Warriors and Warbirds is a nonprofit organization. We started in 2005. We put on an air show in Monroe, North Carolina, at the Charlotte Monroe Executive Airport in November. We usually have it the weekend before Veterans Day. This year it's going to be November 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. And when we started this museum to honor the veterans and teach young people, the sacrifices the veterans have given to live in this free country. And we started as a museum, and we wanted something that would be a little different. So we found Tinkerbell was sold by the CAF, and we worked a deal with CAF and bought Tinkerbell. We worked on it for a year and a half in Midland, Texas. Then we ferried it back to Monroe, North Carolina. And then we worked on another year at Monroe. And the city came to us and wanted to purchase an airplane to promote their aerospace industry in Monroe. It's a heavily populated aerospace industry. And they wanted us to maintain the airplane and furnish all the pilots and all. So we have a relationship with the city that they help with the expense of the airplane. We manage the flying and the labor for all the maintenance and all on it. And we got it flying, guys, to air shows this year, and hope to keep it flying from years to come. It's an expensive airplane to operate. It's got R2800 engines, 2,000 horsepower engines each. Burns about 160, 170 gallons an hour. So it takes a lot of money to keep it running. So that's why we sell T-shirts and charge a little bit to go through it and take a look at it.
I have to admit, when I got aborted, it's bigger than I expected. It's not a little airplane.
No, it's not. That's what everybody says. It's got 108-foot, 1-inch wingspan. It's got an oversized cargo area and the fuselage. That's why they use it so much to fly the hump with and all. It carries a much larger load than the C-47s could at higher altitudes and all. And that's how they got supplies over to the Chinese and Clara Chenault and the Flying Tigers over in China and close to Burma Road.
And I understood from one of your co-workers here on the flight line that it's one of three, and we've actually been fortunate enough to interview Mikey, who owns the other two, on the show. So now I know of all three of them flying in North America.
Okay, great. Yeah, this is the only one flying in the continental United States at this time. The CAF still has China doll out in Camarillo, California. I understand it's not flying right now. It's been grounded. So.
Well, again, tell us where we can find your organization, maybe on the web, and so they can see where Tinkerbell's going to be at the next air show.
Right, we're at warsandwarbirds.com. Like I said, we're in Monroe, North Carolina. Tinkerbell's out in front of the hangar every day. We work on it every day. If they through Monroe, stop by and see us. Somebody will be out there working on it.
Well, thank you very much for being on Airplane Geeks.
Thank you. It's our pleasure.
This is David. I'm in Air Venture, and I'm in Writer's Corner, and I'm sitting right next to friend of the show Jamie Dotson, but we're not here to talk to Jamie because he's been on the show. We're here to talk about James Keefe and his book. James, tell me about your book.
Well, it's called Two Gold Coins and a Prayer: The Epic Journey of a World War II Bomber Pilot, Evader, and POW, and it's a story about my dad's World War II experiences as a B-24 bomber pilot. He was shot down on his fourth mission over Holland, ended up being swept up by the Dutch resistance, and he spent 5 months in Rotterdam at various safe houses evading from the Germans. Eventually, they put him on an escape route into Belgium, but the Germans had infiltrated the line, and he was picked up in Antwerp and became a POW.
And what made you want to write the book?
Well, he had all this information for years up in his head, and he wouldn't write it. So 10 years ago, I said, that's it. I'm going to do it. And 9 years later, got the book out.
How did the book change you?
The biggest change in me was, understanding the Dutch underground and the hell that the civilians had gone through, and they still took care of people like my dad. This thing was going to be a manuscript for the family only until I got into the Dutch underground part of it, and then I had to honor them and tell their story, and so I published a book. That was one of the major things. The other one was understanding my dad more. Growing up with an officer and a career military guy had its pros and cons. But I got to know him and know his early military careers and what shaped him for the rest of his life. And I think that I feel like I know my dad a lot more now.
What did he think of the book?
He was very pleased. When I presented it to him, he said, thankfully you did it now because my memory's slipping away. He's 89, by the way, today or this year. And fortunately, I got it done when I did because we never would have had it now if I had started. And he's just very pleased.
So, where can we get the book?
Well, it's on Amazon.com, one place. My website where I present the book is Appel Publishing, A-P-P-E-L-L Publishing. You can order it through there. There's some contact information on there. If one wants a signed copy, they can email me. But I think Amazon's probably the best way to do it over the Internet.
Well, thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, appreciate it very much.
Well, that does it. Oshkosh 2012 is a wrap. Only 50 weeks till Oshkosh 2013. I would like to thank Rob, Max, and of course Shell for letting me go this year. We hope to bring you more episodes like this. And of course, if you like this, tell your friends. This has been your Airplane Geek reporter, David Vanderhoof, signing off until Oshkosh 2013. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find all our episodes as well as show notes at airplanegeeks.com. Our email address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. That number is 361-GEEKS-01. Opening and closing music is provided by Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com.
Airplane Geeks is proudly sponsored by the 400,000-plus members of AOPA. Check out their website at www.aopa.com.